Got about 20 minutes to open it up for Q&A, dumb discussion before the meal offering. So we'll just open up the floor.
Thank you for your guided meditation on metta. I've tried that this morning and regularly, and I find that when I think about myself, people close to me, people that maybe are difficult in my life, my thoughts get very discursive right away, and then I end up on thoughts that sort of get tangential, and I'm thought, oh, now my thoughts are elsewhere and not focused on the meta. And I'm wondering if you can have any strategies for me about really trying to keep my mind controlled when I'm thinking about these people.
Yeah, I think with if there's with metta towards people who have been difficult for us, who have created maybe difficulties for us or mistreated us, if there's not something that's really nagging, or we've kind of already let go of it, then we maybe don't need to do that. We just come back and have a pleasant meditation. So the metta for people who have perhaps we've been at odds with, or that we've had resistance to seeing things in different way than somebody else, and it's really stirring our if those types of things tend to stir our mind up quite a bit, but we don't want to stir our mind up intentionally just to try to have metta for people who have been difficult for us. If our mind is already fairly peaceful, we can actually just abide in that state of peaceful happiness, well-being. Sometimes it can be helpful to take that sense of well-being and actually mentally share it with someone who has, say, created difficulties for us, or we've had a disagreement with, or even people who have mistreated us. So that's kind of the exercise of sending metta to enemies in terms of the, the definite, if we define that as people who have been at odds with us or been a threat to us or mistreated us in some way. But it's also fine just to abide in a sense of contentment and happiness. We don't, we don't need to, because that's the whole point, is to abide in contentment and happiness. The point isn't to do a metta exercise in order to necessarily have that, be able to pass that test, so to speak. It's more about getting to the end of contentment and happiness. So a lot of times, if we're not able to say forgive people who have mistreated us, that's going to be a block to our own contentment and happiness. But if we're already feeling content and happy, then it's not really necessary to do these exercises, and we can actually just go back into the meditations. And sometimes these things, they have to happen naturally. We might notice that we reach a point in our meditation where there's some sort of block. Usually those blocks are based on things like resentments or things like that that we're holding on to. But if we don't have that, then we don't need to actually necessarily bring those things up if we're already not blocked in our meditation. So these things are more about unblocking those blocks, deepening our practice through actually looking and seeing, okay, what's stopping us from going deeper. If everything's good, then we don't, yeah, we might not need to bring those things up, actually.
Hello. I truly came here not remembering that that you would be out here today and that this would be different from the usual Sunday session. This was my first time being asked to chant the offerings for the five precepts, and I said the words, but what have I bound myself to here? Am I supposed to observe these now for my whole life. What do I do if I fail? Is there a confession? Where do I go for like guidance for complicated situations?
No, I mean it's no pressure, no pressure. It's those the precepts are voluntary things, so you don't have to take on the precepts if you don't think you're ready for some of the precepts or don't necessarily want to. So having chanted them, you could even just keep them for one day, and that's fine. It's not a lifetime commitment taking the precepts. Although many people will relate to them in that way. So if you do want to keep them, then if you do break one, then yes, it's we call it confession, but that's maybe not the best term. It's just we just reveal that we broke it to say a trusted Dhamma friend or a trusted teacher, somebody who we feel comfortable around who might also be keeping the precepts. And just let them know that you broke the precept. And usually then you would make a mental note to redetermine or retake the precepts whenever you were able to do that, say with a teacher. But no, it's not a lifetime commitment. You're able to keep them as long as you want or don't want to. These things are provided just as a foundation for our practice. The Buddha taught that the five precepts is your basic foundation for living a good life, happiness and well-being, and developing a foundation of virtuous conduct. But it's certainly not mandatory.
Is there anything I'm supposed to do to give them away if I, ask for them for one day?
No, just to mentally determine that, okay, I'm just keeping them for this day or And I'm you just make it clear to yourself that when you're not keeping them, then there's no ceremony for untaking the five precepts, not that I know of anyway.
Okay, that was my question.
Right.
Well, I also just kind of stumbled upon this, so I'm really pleased that your theme is forgiveness. Or because that's the one thing I'm working on most, and my struggle is forgiving myself just for anything really, and I'll know to give myself kindness, but then my first thought is, oh, I don't deserve kindness. So what's really helping me is to both show myself kindness and to accept my own kindness, right? That I deserve it, and that's really helped. Because from there, I can go to, oh, I can wish other people kindness, but then, accepting they deserve kindness as well, and so it's going in both ways. It's really helped. So I'd just like to hear your reflections.
Yeah, sometimes also if it's hard to find how hard to be kind to ourselves, hard to forgive ourselves, we also need to investigate in what ways are we not being kind to ourselves, or in what ways do we not think we're deserving of kindness. And when we investigate that, then we can address that directly. So we might think, well, I want to be kind to myself, or they're teaching me to be kind to myself, but I did this thing and I can't forgive myself for it. I made this mistake. I can't forgive myself for it. So one of the things that the Buddha recommends in his teachings is that when we make mistakes and when we do things that genuinely may have been unskillful, unwholesome, or just wrong, then actually one is you can talk it over with somebody, a trusted friend, or you can acknowledge it to yourself and just say, I'm going to try to not do that again because I felt so bad when I did that. Having made that acknowledgement and set up that determination to not do that again, then we can reassure ourselves that we are deserving of our own kindness if we're able to do that. Because a lot of times we do suffer over things that we genuinely did make mistakes. We genuinely did do something wrong. We genuinely did say something we regretted saying, or we did something we regretted doing, but we don't have to keep holding on to that in a way that we're using it as a bludgeon to keep ourselves in a state of feeling bad about it. The fact that we felt bad about it shows that we actually do care about getting better, that we do care about wanting to be better people, to better ourselves. And so we can use reflections like that to convince ourselves we are deserving of our own kindness. And sometimes it's just developing, acquiring a taste for having kindness for ourselves. Sometimes we might even feel that if we're not undergoing some sort of difficulty or we're not suffering, maybe something is wrong because we're not pushing ourselves or we're not striving in the right way. And the Buddha has teaching, the Buddhist teaching is very interesting in that we're actually allowed to be just happy, at ease, and comfortable. And that's actually okay. And one of the ways we do that is to have kindness for ourselves. But it really does, it really is an acquired taste. We sometimes we don't feel like if we're not struggling, we feel like maybe something's wrong, that we're not, you know, we're not doing something we should be doing. But it is okay to actually be comfortable and not be struggling, at least sometimes. Did you have a question? Maybe one more.
I would like to understand a bit more what the Buddha would have to say about metta and the larger social context, especially those of us who are engaged in the profession of conflict, whereby the objective is to win dominance over the other side, either legally or politically. And the role of metta in reconciling those conflicts, which oftentimes result from political, financial, or legal processes. And from a construct, it seems that our culture and society is set up for conflict and for kind of a anti-meta construction. And it's very difficult to reconcile at this point in my life how much conflict that we actually create for gain of one party or another.
Yeah, it's an excellent question and one that's not easy to answer. When the Buddha talks about metta, it's not necessarily about getting the right political party in power or the one, or necessarily on a societal wide scale. There are Buddhist legends, and part of the Buddhist cosmology, the Buddha talks about the legends of the wheel turning monarch, that there are rare times in history where there is harmony throughout the world. That's very, very rare and not to be expected. And so in a way it is anti-metta. It's actually set, the world is set up for conflict, and the world is owned by Mara. Mara is the Buddhist version of say the Lord of illusion, or the Lord of delusion, the Lord of ignorance. And so the defilements, greed, hatred, and delusion, they rule the world, and that's what makes the world turn, so to speak. However, there, you know, we do get involved in legal disputes. There are things we need to do in the world, especially people who might be engaged in a more direct way. The Buddha's teachings on metta can be applied to the world in the sense that, say we see or hear about things that are really awful that are happening in the world. So wars, for example. So we see or hear about these things and we have our idea, you know, which side is maybe correct, which side is not correct. Now, when any normal person who sees or hears about atrocities happening in the world will feel sick to their stomach, have a sense of wanting to do something about it, have a sense of wanting to make it right somehow. That's good. That's normal. Any good person will experience that. However, when it goes a step further and we become angry and upset because of that, the Buddha's teachings would see that as adding to the general pool of anger in the world. So when we see that, and yes, it's totally normal to have righteous anger. Any good person will have that when they experience some sort of atrocities or injustice in the world. However, the Buddha's teaching says, wait a minute, that's actually, even though on a logical, rational level, you're fighting against something bad with your anger, that anger is adding to the general pool of anger. So you're actually adding that same exact energy that you're fighting against. You're adding that to the world. That's why the Buddha is very radical in saying, come back to absolute forgiveness, absolute love. And that's the only way to, then you're adding that to the general pool of goodness and love in the world. Of course, that's not easy to do, but that's why we do these guided meditations about, say, people or groups we might be upset with. Actually, can we actually experience love in our mind when we think about the worst that the world has to offer? And there are examples in history of this happening and wars. There was a civil war in Liberia that was ended through love. And really, that's the only way to end a war in the best way possible. It was ended by 300 women standing in a line singing in front of the soldiers who were about to slaughter a village of 20,000 people. And that actually ended a civil war. And so it can happen. And these things, you know, when wars end, they don't get televised. And so we don't get to hear about these really inspiring stories. They only get revealed. What gets shown to us is the worst conflict when it's happening and ramping up. But when the conflict ends, then they go and find another conflict to show us. They don't show us how it ended. So it is good to think about very powerful things like that that have happened in the world. But it's very hard to do because it is a visceral reaction to want to get angry at anger, to get angry at injustice is a visceral reaction that a good person will tend to have. So it takes training. Love takes training. Maybe one more if you had a question. Yeah. Somebody raised their hand. So.
Thank you so much for being here today. Curious if you have any thoughts on why loving kindness is, for me personally, sometimes hardest for people that are closest to me, that are irritate me, that I love deeply. I'm asking for a friend, obviously. If you have any thoughts on how it is sometimes very difficult to have that same love and compassion for people that are very, very close to you and who perceive that you should be loving kindness because you do this practice.
You're a Buddhist.
And I'm asking for a
friend. You're supposed to have loving kindness for me. Yeah, that is always how it is, whether it's family, teachers, friends, that's always how it is. So they're those people that we have the most relationship with, you know, there's the most grist for the mill there. And I can't say why that is, but that is always how it is. It may be just because that's who we have the most relationship with and the most, that's, you know, they're going to see the good and the bad in us, and we're going to see the good and the bad in them because we just have the closest relationship. And that is the best place for growth also, because that's highlighting for us where we're stuck. So when we get in one place in the suttas, the Buddha defines metta as non-irritation. So how hard is it to just not get irritated? So that's what happens in the monastery, where It's been said that there was a Western disciple of Ajahn Chah, Paul Breiter. He said, at a certain point, you're convinced that the monk sitting next to you is responsible for at least 70% of the suffering in the world. And that's how it is, just because you're sitting next to the person. Or the example I like to give, which is a real example from a Baigiri, is that, becoming enraged with the monk sitting next to you because of how they eat lettuce. It just, this is, it's just like you, the mind tends to focus on those things. So it really does take training to say, okay, you eat lettuce like that? No problem. Okay, this person is doing their thing. All right, it's all good. This person's, okay, I had this, okay, walking on the trail, there's somebody laying on their back on the trail. Looks like they're just going through something. All right, no need to get irritated. It's just they're just doing their thing. And you'd kind of develop, sometimes it's about developing little tricks, little tactics. If somebody comes at you, tells you off, there's little pro tips, like take a deep breath, take a breath before you react. That can be very helpful. If somebody is angry at you or tells you off, you can take a deep breath before speaking. So sometimes we develop little tricks. Sometimes it's a more overarching, okay. And not to be hard on ourselves if we do get angry or if we do get irritated, just say, okay, I'm not there yet. This is how it is right now. This is where I need to work. And just making note of that's where I need to work. So that's usually how we deal with things like that.
Thank you. Yeah.